This is Audible.
Clearstone, Wyoming. Written by J.C. Halsey. Narrated by Chaz Allen. Chapter 1. Orville, Half-Loaf, Wolf, and I returned last night from a failed hunting trip in the mountains of Angry Orchard, Colorado. We'd gone there to hunt some elk, but it got cold and started snowing so much that we called it off and returned to the warm room at the hotel. Early the next morning, I was awakened by the telegraph operator, who had a telegram marked urgent. I opened it and saw it was from Dr. Ferguson, the doctor I met on the stage when traveling from Velvet Sky, Arizona, to here. The telegram stated that the town of Clearstone, Wyoming, needed my help. There were some men going there to inflict bodily harm on some of their leading citizens. They hadn't arrived yet, but they were expected at any time. If I could come, they wanted me as soon as possible, and it was signed by Dr. Ferguson. I talked it over with Orville and Half-Loaf, and we all agreed that we needed to do this. If there were any people that needed our help, it was our duty to help them. Orville, Half-Loaf, myself, and Wolf, a dog, and the newest member of our ragtag group, were going to start out for what we hoped would be about a 6 to 8 day trip. Thinking back, I had traveled by stagecoach from Velvet Sky because the killer was already here. So time was of the essence then. After that situation was taken care of and I was waiting for my friends, Orville and Half-Loaf, to arrive, I enjoyed walking around visiting with the people of Angry Orchard, especially Walter Barnes, the owner of the livery stable. I escaped from a lovesick young lady that was bound and determined to marry me, and then I rescued a dog. Couldn't find a permanent home for the dog, so I decided to make him a member of our group and name him Wolf. Orville said everything was still packed from our failed hunting trip to the mountains, so we could leave for Clearstone at any time. Well, let's eat breakfast and check our outfit again to make doubly sure we have everything we need for the trip, I said. That sounds like a good plan, Orville said. Where are we going to eat? Oh, let's go to Shirley's. She was real nice to Wolf and me while we were waiting for you guys. We went to Shirley's Cafe, where I told Wolf to wait like he always did by the door. Orville, Half-Loaf, and myself found a table in the back and sat down. When Shirley came to wait on us, I said to her, "Want to thank you for being so nice to me and Wolf while we were waiting for Orville and Half-Loaf to show up." "Aw, shucks," she said, "that weren't no trouble at all. I enjoyed doing it. I would have thrown all those scraps out anyway. He saved me the trouble. Here's a little something for him that you can take with you. Now, what do you fellas have?" We ordered a big breakfast, and it filled us up all the way. We said goodbye to Shirley. Gave her a big tip. Orville said, "I know you can't marry me, but you could give an old man a big hug, couldn't you?" "On one condition," she said, "that I get a hug from all three of you, okay? And a hug from Wolf, too." We lined up, and each of us gave her a hug that would have to last, as we probably wouldn't be coming this way again. She stepped outside and gave Wolf a hug and told him she was going to miss him. He whined and licked her face. We left Shirley's and went to the livery stable, where we had our horses and wagon. "I was just a bit younger. I just might take off and go with you fellers," said Rufus. "You ain't a lot older than me," said Orville. "Maybe just a mite," he said. "Too much to be traipsing all over the country. Just have to say goodbye and good luck to you." We all shook hands, then settled up, hooked up the horses in the wagon. We waved goodbye, took off. "How fur did you say it was?" Orville asked. "Oh, not quite 100 miles, I said. "Should be there in a little over a week's time if we don't run into trouble." "Now that's something I could do without," said Orville. "Me also. I want no trouble," said Half-Loaf. "How about you, Jed? You want trouble?" "I don't think I have to answer that silly question," I said. Chapter 2. Wolf was having a really good time. He was checking under every rock and every crevice, behind every tree and cactus, under every bush, and up and down the valley. As I filled my lungs with the cold January morning air, I thought about something that I'd heard. I'd been told that in the summer the prairie would be covered with wildflowers, and you could see the endless flatland filled with dry riverbeds, rough gullies, rocky gulches, mesquite trees filled with leaves, and blooming prickly pear bushes. Everything's just as pretty now, but in a different way. The sun was blasting a brilliant yellow over the tops of the tall mountains, and the green aspen trees scattered across the base caused contrasting colors in the white snow. What a wonderful sight it was to behold! God sure knew how to put things together for a pretty picture. I do wish that I could have seen the beauty of the summer months. I'm going to miss this, but I have to go where God leads me. Chapter 3. We came upon a burned-out wagon. It looked to have been sitting there for a couple of days. The people inside the wagon were burned beyond recognition. We assumed they were man and his wife. Thank God it didn't look like they had kids. The horses were gone, and the items were scattered all around. The Indians had ripped and destroyed any and all things they didn't want to take with them. We buried them a little way from the wagon. When we got through burying the man and the woman in a common grave, we heard what sounded a little like a baby crying coming from the bushes. And Wolf perked up his ears. "What is it, Wolf?" "Let's go see," I said. We all went over, and there in the bushes was a young Indian brave. He was in pretty bad shape. The other Indians must have thought he'd run off when the fighting started, or maybe they didn't care because he was so young that they didn't bother looking for him. He was probably 10 or 11 years old, too young to be going on a raid like this. Orville said, "Best thing for him is to shoot him, put him out of his misery." "Well, we can't do that without even trying to help him," Half-Loaf said, looking very concerned. "All right, let's get him in the back of the wagon," said Orville. He moaned loudly when we picked him up. We laid him in the back of the wagon, and Half-Loaf handed a canteen to me. I lifted him so he could drink. Very little water got down his throat, but he did manage a little. His wound was bad, so I cleaned it and saw that the bullet had to come out. I asked, "Could you take out a bullet, Orville?" "Oh, I did it a few times in the war, but can't make no promise," he answered. "Just do the best you can," I said. "Build a fire, Half-Loaf, and eat some water. Get Orville's peeling knife and set it in the coals of the fire. Also, get that bottle of whiskey from under the wagon seat. Bring it in here." I got some towels from the wagon and put them beside the youth. When the knife was hot, Orville said, "Better hold him down. This knife slips. He won't have no chance at all." Half-Loaf and me held him down so he wouldn't thrash around, and Orville started pushing the knife into the wound. "I can feel it," he said. "Now if I can just twist the knife up this way and there it is. Ain't it something that such a little thing could do so much damage?" As he held up the tiny bit of lead, "Jed, you clean out with that whiskey and then put a clean dressing on it. Try to give him a little more water. It's about all we can do right now. We'll see how he's doing in a couple of hours." Well, a couple of hours went by, and he started trembling and shaking. "Cover him with those blankets," said Orville. "He got a fever. Bathe his forehead with a wet bandana, and I'll cook up a little broth from some jerky. Add a few herbs. Try to get him to drink a little. If the fever breaks, he just might survive to kill another white man." Chapter 4. I said to Half-Loaf, "Why don't you go shoot a couple of rabbits? They'll make better broth than jerky." Somewhere around midnight, his fever broke, and he started mumbling and trying to sit up. "Hold on there, young feller," Orville said as he gently pushed him back down. "You ain't got the strength to sit up yet. Here, drink a little of this broth, and it'll make you feel better." The lad pushed the cup so hard that it spilled. "That's all right," said Orville. "We got more." He lay back down on the pallet, then opened his eyes again and saw Wolf. He said something in Indian language. Wolf jumped up on the wagon and lay beside him, whimpering and licking his hand. The youngster laid his hand on Wolf's head and said in perfect English, "Is this your dog? Do you call him Wolf? That is my name also. I am Lean Wolf." "Yes," I said, "his name is Wolf. He isn't anyone's dog. He's an equal partner with us," I answered. "Some of my people eat dogs," the young man said. "I do not think this is right. Dogs are spirit beings, just as we are." "Think you're right about that," I said. "No one should eat another spirit being. Can you tell us from what tribe you come from?" "I am Arapaho. I was on my vision quest when I came across this Cheyenne war party attacking the white wagon. I tried to run away and hide, but they saw me and shot me. It hurt very much. Thank you for helping me. I am grateful. I must think of a way to repay you." "No need to repay us. That's what we do. Help those who need help. Do you remember where your tribe's located?" I asked him. "Yes, it is 8 miles to the east, near Fort Bennington. I have been gone for a long time. My people will be concerned for me." "Well, when you feel up to it, We'll take you to your village, I said, maybe first thing in the morning. Thank you again. Now I think I will rest. And he laid his head back down on the pallet. Reckon those renegade Indians still be on the prod round close? Asked Orville. We'll just have to be extra watchful from here on out, I said. If they're still around, I don't think we'll be such an easy target as those pilgrims were, God rest their souls. Half-Loaf commented, we should still be able to put up a pretty good fight with those rifles we bought back at Finnegan's store. Let's just keep a close lookout for anything out of the ordinary, I said. Chapter 5. I met quite a few Indians when I helped Pa in the livery stable back in Angel Falls, and every one of them was polite and seemed to me to know as much as the majority of the people I knew. A lot of town folks didn't mind having the Indians around, and I always thought the Indians had a legitimate gripe. After all, they'd been shoved off their land many times and signed many treaties, which have been broken time after time, and not by them. Many of the tribes banded together to try making life easier for their people. They were accused of not living up to the treaties when, really, it was some renegade white men who broke them. What would you do if your home was invaded? When the Indians killed white men to protect their homes, troops were sent in to destroy them. The Sand Creek Massacre, also known as the Shivington Massacre, the Battle of Sand Creek, or the Massacre of Cheyenne Indians, was an atrocity in the Indian Wars that occurred on November 29, 1864, when a 700-man force of Colorado Territory militia attacked and destroyed a peaceful village of Cheyenne and Arapaho encamped in southeastern Colorado Territory, killing and mutilating an estimated 70 to 163 Indians, about two-thirds of whom were women and children. Incidents such as this were happening all the time, so can we really blame them for being upset? Many white people think that Indians are inferior, not as intelligent as them. Just because someone's culture is different doesn't mean they're inferior. The boy had been gaining his strength back, more each day. We had detoured from our journey to take him back to his village, and as we looked off into the distance, we saw smoke swirling into the air, and pretty soon we saw the fort. It didn't look very big, but if it got the job done, it would do. We pulled up to the gate, and the guard asked what our business was at the fort. We told him we had an injured Indian with us, and we were bringing him back to his people. Indian agencies around the north side of the fort, the guard said. Agent Ferris is the one you'll want to see. We went around to the agency and stopped in front. A dark-skinned man stepped out in the porch and stood looking at us. What can I do for you, gentlemen? Well, we have a young Arapaho boy named Lean Wolf with us. He was injured when we found him. He's better now, wants to come home. Is this the right place to bring him? I asked. Yes, of course. Bring him inside. We'll find his folks for you. Chapter 6. We helped him inside the agency. He was still very weak as we helped him sit on a bench just inside the door. Thank you so much, Jed, Half-Loaf Wolf, and especially you, Orville. If you had not cut out the bullet, I would surely have died, he said. Oh, speaking of bullets, how'd you like this one as a souvenir? Maybe make a necklace or something out of it, Orville said as he gave him the bullet. Thank you. I will think of you all when I look at it. Can you please wait? I would like you to meet my father and mother. Yes, we can wait for a spell, I told him. They'll be here shortly, said the agent. Would you like something to drink? We have water, of course, and we have cider, lemonade, and sassafras tea. It's an Indian drink. I'll try some of that tea, said Orville. Maybe it'll be like iced tea. How did Lean Wolf get injured, if I might ask, said the agent. Well, he told us he was on a vision quest and a Cheyenne war party shot him, I answered. Yeah, I heard there was about a dozen Cheyenne braves raiding all around, said the agent. Troops haven't been able to catch him so far. Haven't given up, though. An elderly Indian gentleman and a younger woman came into the agency. The woman was very excited to see Lean Wolf, but the man stood almost at attention. It was their way. The men weren't very emotional in public. I did, however, sense that he was indeed happy to see his son. The old man spoke in Arapaho. The agent turned and said, "They don't speak English, but he said the village and he thanks you, white man. He's very happy to see his boy." Tell him we're glad to help him, and we wish his family and whole tribe to have many good things bestowed upon them. Now I reckon we better be going, I said, and I turned to Lean Wolf and said, take care of yourself. Goodbye. I think I saw a tear in Lean Wolf's eyes. Maybe not, because just like his elderly father, he was not supposed to show his emotions in public. Goodbye, good friends, said Lean Wolf. I will pray to the Great Spirit for him to shower you with many blessings. If you would, please let me say goodbye to Wolf alone. I would be so grateful. He said something to his parents and the agent. Then they left. We likewise said goodbye again and waited outside. In a few minutes, Wolf came out, and we were on our way. Taking care of Lean Wolf had slowed us down a bit. We lost 2 days from our agenda. However, we felt it was a good delay. We had done what God ordained us to do to help those in need. The landscape wasn't a lot different. It was still as pretty as what we had passed through. We kept all our rifles with bullets in the chamber. All we had to do was cock it and shoot. We were hoping it wouldn't come to that. However, we felt if trouble did come, we were ready. Do you think we could win against 12 braves? Asked Half-Loaf. Do you notice back at that burned wagon there were a few broken arrows laying around? I said. I think that means our braves don't have any guns, just bows and arrows, so yes. I think we could win if we take our time and shoot straight, I explained. I can shoot straight, said Half-Loaf. Thanks to you, Jed. Let's just hope we don't have to fight, I said. What do you say we travel a little later tonight and try to make up for lost time? Sounds good, Orville said, but don't want to push too awful hard. Animals need rest, too. Chapter 7 We came to a large enclosure with a big stockade fence all around. I didn't know how many acres it surrounded, but it was a lot. I could see that. We need water for the horses, said Orville. So I reckon we better see if we can get an invite to go inside. I have seen places like this in Mexico, said Half-Loaf. The people on the inside were not very friendly. Well, this ain't Mexico, Orville said as he got down, walked up to the large gate, and banged really hard. The gate opened slightly, and a black man looked out. Oui, maman. We just want to water our animals. That be all right, I asked. I has to see what the massa has to say. Stay where you is. I be back. And he pushed the gate closed. About 10 minutes passed, the gate opened again. This time there was an elderly man dressed in all white and wearing a white Panama hat. He bowed from the waist and said, I'm Major Hiram G. Calhoun of Covington, West Virginia. Please come inside and enjoy the hospitality of our house. Please bring your wagon and horses in. It's a half mile to the main house. Thomas, close the gate when the gentlemen are inside. He mounted a big, beautiful white stallion, and we followed behind. There were trees all along each side of the path, with 12 small cabins, 6 on one side and 6 on the other. These are breeders' quarters, Calhoun pointed out. The main quarters are farther over behind the breeders' quarters. Are you saying you own slaves? Asked Orville. Calhoun answered, Of course, I own 35 at this time. Thomas is the one you met at the gate. Been with me almost his whole life. I bought him when he was 10 years old. Here we are. Main house is just around that corner. We are self-supported here. We grow most everything we need right here at By the Wood. What we don't grow, Thomas takes a wagon, goes to Scurrytown to get. It's a small settlement about 10 miles west of here. Thomas is my overseer. Most folks won't have a nigger for an overseer. But I believe Thomas does a good job. He can do most everything. If any of them has any smarts at all, it would be Thomas. As we turned the corner, there was an enormous mansion, sitting in the middle of the Colorado prairie. Please, gentlemen, come into the house and enjoy a mint julep. Very good, even in this god-awful cold weather. Orville said when Calhoun wasn't looking, Don't he know the war ended slavery? Apparently not, I said. Let's just play along until we find out what's going on. We told Calhoun we needed to water the horses. Oh, don't concern yourselves with that. Thomas will see to it that they're well taken care of. Please come inside. We went inside with him. As he stepped up on the porch, the door opened, and a large black woman was standing there. Calhoun handed her his hat and kept walking. May I take your hats, gentlemen? She said, and we handed her our hat, and she said, This way, please. We followed her down a dark hallway, and she turned into a second door. Calhoun was already seated in an oversized chair. Take any place to sit, he said. Mama June, bring us some fresh mint juleps. Make sure they're fresh. Yes, sir, Mr. Calhoun, she said. She was back in a fairly short time, and she poured a glass for Mr. Calhoun. Then she poured each of us one. Thank you, Mama June, was it? I asked. You don't have to thank them, exclaimed Calhoun. If you do, they'll start to expect it. You'll spoil them. You have to constantly show them who the master is. You do know the war ended, Orville asked. Course I know, said Calhoun, but my niggers don't know. Besides, as I said, the majority of them have been with me for many years. Where would they go if they had their freedom? They's just ignorant, uneducated animals. Orville was beginning to get red in the face. Half-Loaf asked to be excused and left the room. Don't you think they should have a choice to be free or not? I asked. Of course they shouldn't have a choice, he said. They don't think, they just act, just like a dog or a horse. I wondered why God led us this way, but now I believe I see why, Mr. Calhoun. I have something to explain to you, and I want you to listen very carefully, so there will be no misunderstandings on your part. A lot of men who gave their lives so people like Thomas, Mama June, and all the others could have a choice about freedom. Now, you're probably right that the majority of your slaves wouldn't know what to do if they were free, but they would know if they were educated, and that's one of the things you're going to do. You're going to hire a teacher to come here and teach these people. Then you'll build better houses for them to live in. You'll pay them a salary for the work they've been doing all this time. And don't tell me you don't have the funds for all this. I could look around and see differently. In January 1865, General William T. Sherman issued Special Field Order No. 15. The order reserved coastal land in Georgia and South Carolina for black settlements. Each family would receive 40 acres, a quarter-acre section. In the end, the order was rescinded by President Andrew Jackson, but we aren't going to let that happen here, are we? I realize that, as you stated, your slaves wouldn't know what to do if they had their freedom. However, their children and grandchildren will know because they're going to be educated. I also think this stockade fence needs to be torn down so they can begin to get the feeling of being free. I realize this is going to be hard for you to accept and change the way you believe, but in the end, you'll be a much better person for it. You might say that you'll agree, and then when we're gone, you'll be back to your wicked ways, but believe me, I will find out, and that would upset me very much, and I would have to return and explain it all over again, and I don't like to have to repeat myself. Are you understanding so far? Just shake your head if you understand. Calhoun nodded. Well, that's very good, I said, and I'm so glad we had this little talk. I feel we accomplished a lot. Now, we need to continue on our journey. We stood, as did he. Good day to you, sir, I said. We'll let ourselves out. Thomas was waiting outside with our wagon and horses. Thomas, I said, let's sit here on the porch. I want to tell you something that will make a big difference in your life. I explained everything to him, and then I told him that if these things didn't happen the way I explained, then he should go to a place that has a sheriff and ask him to send a telegram to me. And I handed him a piece of paper with the information written on it. This paper is very important, I said. Guard it with your life. And I stuck out my hand. He slowly took it in his. I gripped it and shook his hand. Never shook no white man's hand before. Well, I hope you get to shake many more, I said. Watch over your people. Goodbye. God bless you, Thomas. We mounted up, rode down that tree-lined lane, through the gate, and got back on the way to Clearstone, Wyoming. Chapter 8 You believe that guy? Exclaimed Orville. War's been over nigh on 5-6 years, and he still thinks he can own another person. There's a lot of ignorant people in this country, I said. Maybe we enlightened one of them about the way things are supposed to be. Maybe, Orville mumbled. I hope those men haven't showed up in Clearstone yet, I said. I sure wasn't planning on any of these delays. Ain't that the way with life, though, said Orville. Make plans, then something comes along and changes those plans. So you have to make new plans. Then something comes along and you have to make new plans. Well, you get the picture. We just have to remember that God's in charge, I said. Things happen because he wants them to. The Bible in Psalm 37:23 says, The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delighteth in his way. Ain't there a verse that says, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down, a time to build? Asked Orville. Well, yes, the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament, chapter 3. There's a time for everything. How do you remember all the Bible verses, Jed? Asked Half-Loaf. Well, I just read the Bible and asked God to bless my reading and to plant His Word in my heart and mind. Chapter 9. The mountains' shapes and shadows seem to shift and change, and the colors seem to blend and blur together as the sun's bright yellow and gold hue appeared over the tops. It was indeed a wondrous sight. The next day, after leaving the stockade, we saw Indians off in the distance, just out of rifle range. "Reckon it's them renegades?" asked Orville. I answered and said, "I don't think there'd be any others following us." They followed for almost 2 days. On the second day, one of them rode closer, carrying a white flag. I told the others to stay alert while I rode out to see what he wanted. He raised his hand in greeting, and I did the same. "What you got in wagon? You got whiskey?" he said. I said, "No, no whiskey." "What you got trade for life?" "We don't have anything of value," I said. "What value?" "We don't have anything you would want," I said. "Maybe we take wagon. Maybe we kill you, your friends." I looked at him and said, "Maybe you would try. We won't be as easy as the last wagon you burned. Maybe we kill many braves if you try." "You got tobacco? You give tobacco, we let go." "We don't have tobacco either," I said. "We have nothing that you would want to die for. We travel in peace. We want no trouble. We don't want to kill Indians, but if you attack us, we will kill many braves, maybe even you, before you kill us. We have new carbines and plenty of ammunition, and we all shoot straight. Maybe we kill all braves, and then we travel to our home. We do not want to kill. That is not our way. We are men of peace. I go now." I turned and rode back to the wagon. Didn't look to see what he was doing. I trusted my friends to watch for me. When I got back, I turned in the saddle and looked, and the Indians were gone. "What did you say to him?" asked Half-Loaf. "Whatever it was convinced him." "We still need to stay alert," I said. We watched close for the next 2 days. Then we eased up a little. However, you always have to stay vigilant when you're traveling. Chapter 10. Half-Loaf was getting very good at shooting rabbits, but I was kind of getting tired of eating them. Orville had fixed it many different ways, but still the same thing day after day was getting old. He'd killed a couple of prairie hens, and they were delicious, but we needed to find a town or settlement and stock up on bacon and beans. You know, I never seem to get tired of beans and bacon, and after 4 days of traveling, we saw a small shanty town up ahead and off to the right. We turned towards it, and in a few minutes we were rolling down Main Street. Of course, there was but one Main Street. There were 5 shacks and a corral with 3 horses. Chickens were running in the street, and all the buildings were poorly constructed. I don't think the people were planning on staying here for a very long period. We stopped in front of a building with a sign that read, Monty Ward. I don't know if they were trying to be funny, Montgomery Ward, or if that was their name. We went inside, and it was like most stores, dark and gloomy. Boxes, crates, and barrels were stacked all around. Didn't seem to be any sort of order to it. In front of the counter were 2 large sacks of flour, and there was a big barrel of pickles on the floor. Next to them was a barrel of crackers. Standing behind the counter was a tall, thin man, probably 6'7", maybe even more. He had long, stringy gray hair and was wearing leather breeches with a stained white shirt that was extremely large. He looked with hazel eyes through small, wire-rimmed glasses. "Howdy, strangers. If you want it, I probably got it. Finding it might be a problem, but we'll try." Orville asked, "You got any bacon and beans?" "Oh, sure. We always got them things. How much you figure to need?" man answered. "Oh, I reckon 20 pounds of bacon," said Orville, "and you got canned or dried beans?"
"We got both," answered the man. "How many and which kind?"
"I think we'll get 20 cans," said Orville. "How about 10 pounds of dried?"
"What else?" asked the man. "You fellows look like you're traveling pretty far. Surely you need more than bacon and beans."
"Well, let me think for a minute," said Orville. "I reckon we might as well fill up on what's missing.
Give me a bushel of wheat, barrel of flour, 3 pounds of cornmeal, gallon of molasses, 2 pounds of lard, 2 pounds of butter, if you got it, 10 pounds of sugar, 3 pounds of cheese, 5 pounds of rice, and we better get some of these crackers to go with the cheese. And give me 2 gallons of these pickles. Wow, you filling up, ain't you? Exclaimed the man. Are you complaining? Asked Orville. Oh, no, sir, said the man. We's glad to get your business. Not many folks pass this way. Kind of out of the way. But you see, Miss Flora runs the settlement. Nothing goes on here without her knowing about it. She runs a real tight ship, so I'll have to get her okay before I can sell this big an order of supplies. Ain't you in the business of selling? Asked Orville. Well, yes, of course, but as I said, Miss Flora is in charge. I'll be right back. He went through the back door and was soon back with a large woman who looked to be in her 50s, maybe a little less. She looked like she was mad at something. She glanced at the counter with all the supplies stacked on it, then turned and looked us up and down. "What you fellows want with all these goods?" she asked. "I don't just sell goods to anybody that comes along. Where y'all say you're going?" "Didn't you say?" said Orville. "I think maybe I got these goods sold already," she said. "Y'all gonna have to get y'all's goods someplace else. How about if we just got some beans and bacon? Would that be okay?" I asked. "I reckon I can let you have a little beans and bacon," she said. "Well, that's really all we came in for anyway," I said. "How much do we owe you?" $10 ought to cover it," she said. "Well, I feel like that's just steep," I said. "How about $5? "I reckon I can live with that," she said. "Y'all come back now, yeah?" "Why on earth anybody'd want to do business with them folks is beyond me," Orville said as we were leaving. "People are different," I said. "There's lots of funny ideas floating around in their heads. We got our beans and bacon, and that's what we wanted, isn't it?" "I reckon," Orville said. We loaded up our goods, then took our horses over to the water trough and let them drink a little while. We didn't want them to drink too much, as we were going right back on the trail.
Chapter 11. I figured that we were still about a day and a half from Clearstone. Wolf was still running every which way. What he was searching for, your guess is as good as mine. He wouldn't ride in the wagon for a long time. He'd like to run free. "Wolf's sure having fun, ain't he?" Orville commented. "Yes, he's a completely different dog than when I found him," I answered. "All he needed was the same as us humans, someone to care for him."
"Got that now, don't he, Half Loaf?" asked Orville.
"Yes, Wolf is a fine dog," said Half Loaf. "He has made me not to be afraid, and that is good."
"What do you say about stopping a little early for camp today?" asked Orville. "My old bones is aching from bouncing on this wooden seat."
"Whatever makes you feel good's good by me," I told him. "Looks like a good spot up ahead in that bunch of willow trees. Could be water there." We pulled up and dismounted. Sure enough, there was a small puddle of muddy water, about a 4-foot circle right smack in the middle of the trees.
"There is usually water where there's willow trees," said Orville, "though not always."
The horses didn't mind the mud. They drank until the puddle was almost empty. We moved them away, and pretty soon it was full again.
"Ain't it odd how that happens?" said Orville.
"Just seems to come out of nowhere." "Yes, I'm always surprised at the wonders of God's creation," I answered. All of a sudden, Half Loaf sprawled face down in the mud, sputtering and spitting. Orville couldn't contain his laughter, and that's all it took for Half Loaf to lose his cool. He stood up in the middle of the mud puddle, reached down and grabbed 2 handfuls of mud, and threw it towards Orville. Orville wasn't quick enough to get out of the way, and the mud hit him square in the face. Then he was the one sputtering and spitting.
"You cantankerous young whippersnapper," hollered Orville. "You're going to be sorry for that."
"You should not have laughed at my misfortune," said Half Loaf.
"Oh, I tried not to laugh, but couldn't help myself," said Orville. "I'm sorry, Half Loaf. I shouldn't have laughed."
"And I, too, am sorry," said Half Loaf. "I should not have thrown mud at you."
"Are you two lovebirds finished?" I asked jokingly.
As soon as Orville got cleaned up, he had something to eat in an amazing short time. That was another thing for me to ponder, how he could fix something fit to eat in such a short time. When we were finished eating and the dishes were cleaned and put away, we just sat around the fire reminiscing about things that had happened in our lives. As Orville and Half Loaf talked, I leaned back on my pallet and looked up. Sometimes when I look at the stars, I wonder about that old saying, "When you wish upon a star," and that I would silently make a wish that someday I could have a normal life. But as soon as I wished it,
it seemed as if I could hear a voice that said, "What you are doing is normal for you. There are many people in this country that need help, and you've been chosen to help them. This is what I wish for you to do." Then, as I felt an inner peace come over me, I closed my eyes and fell into a deep, relaxing slumber. Chapter 12. I was awakened the next morning by some rustling in the bushes. I glanced around, and there at the side of our camp stood a salt and pepper-colored wild boar staring over its pig-like snout with its beady little eyes. It snorted and shook its dagger-like tusks, then pawed the ground. I told Wolf to get in the wagon and stay. Then I spoke softly to Orville and Halfloaf and advised them of the situation. We all reached for our carbines. I was hoping we wouldn't have to shoot it, but with a javelina, you just never know what to expect. Wolf was growling, and the hare was standing up on his back. Orville said, "We need to go ahead and shoot it. It would be good eating for quite a spell, and the cold would keep the meat fresh for a while. What do you say? Have fresh pork for supper?" "Sure," I said, "but let's let Halfloaf shoot it." "All right, go ahead," said Orville. "Halfloaf, you get the honor of shooting our supper." "Do you want me to shoot it with my pistol?" he asked. "I have not shot before with my rifle. I might miss, and it could run off." "Tell you what, if you miss," I said, "I'll shoot it. Either way, we'll have pork for supper." Halfloaf cocked his rifle, looked down the sights, and slowly squeezed the trigger. The boar toppled over without taking a step. It was a clean headshot. "Great shooting, Halfloaf," Orville and I told him. He was grinning from ear to ear. He was so proud. "Okay, who's going to butcher and clean it?" asked Orville. "I reckon since I'm going to be the one cooking it, the cleaning honor should go to someone else." "All right," I said. "I guess Halfloaf and I'll take care of it." It took us over an hour to skin and start to cut it up. Orville said, "Oh, just cut a few slices off the hind quarter and leave the rest. It'll be easier to carry and manage the whole carcass. I think I can stir up enough flour to make about 6 biscuits. How's that sound?" "Are you going to feed Wolf some of this meat?" asked Halfloaf. "No, he can wait until it's cooked," I answered. "I don't want him eating fresh meat." A short time later, there was a smell in the air that made my mouth water. Fried pork and freshly baked biscuits. Who could want anything else? Chapter 13. I could feel that we were getting close to Clearstone. We were rolling along at a pretty good clip. Off to our right, I spied an old man and a mule, and we held up as he traveled towards us.
"Howdy, neighbor," he said.
"Howdy yourself, old-timer. Where are you bound?" I said.
"I just left Clearstone on my way to East Butte, about 40 miles over yonder. I was told there's a pocket of minerals in that section."
"So you're a prospector, are you?" I asked.
"That's right, sonny. Been doing it for nigh on 50 years now. Expect I'm about due to hit a big one."
"Well, we wish you luck," I told him.
"No luck to it. Just being in the right spot at the right time. I figure this is the right time, and up yonder is the right spot. Say, you ain't got no tobacco, do you?"
"No, sorry, we don't smoke," I said.
"Oh, tain't for me. It's for rabbit ears. That's my mule. He don't smoke, but he does like to chew it."
"Sorry," I said, "we can't help you. However, we do have some oats if you want him to chew on them."
"Reckon I'll take you up on that offer. He likes oats almost as much as tobacco."
Orville scooped out about a 1/2 gallon of oats, put them in a burlap sack, and gave it to the old man.
"We both say thank you kindly. I'll remember you when I hit that big strike. Gotta get moving. Good day to you."
"Say, how'd you like some fresh pork?" asked Orville. "We killed us a wild boar ways back. We got plenty."
"I appreciate the offer, but I never cared much for wild hog. Thank you just the same. Say, if you fellas are planning on going to Clearstone, I would recommend that you take the left fork about 2 miles up yonder and detour round town."
"Oh, why's that, old-timer?"
"Well, I heard there's a couple of desperados headed for town. They plan on stirring up a mess of trouble. Say they're going to kill a couple of folks, a judge and another man. They say because they spent 5 years in prison. Way I see it is you do the crime, you ought to do the time. Of course, they don't see it that way. Better take the left fork. Safest way."
"Well, thanks for the advice," I said. "Those desperados you speak of are the reason we're going to Clearstone."
"Well, you must be that avenging angel of the West they've been talking about. Is that who you are?"
I don't know anything about being an angel, I said, but I'm here to avenge the wrong that's coming to town.
Well, I reckon if you're as fast as they say you are, you ain't got to worry none, he said. I'm going to mosey on down the road. I feel it's going to be a time I strike the mother lode. So long.
So long, I said, and good luck to you.
Chapter 14. We rode into town and headed straight for the livery stable.
Howdy, folks. My name's Orville Whitmore. You traveled far? Bring your horses inside and pull your wagon alongside the building. Reckon you'll be staying long?
No, a lot of folks say I talk too much and ask too many questions. I don't know. If I don't ask, can't find out anything.
Folks don't have to answer, I reckon.
Well, we'll be staying for at least a couple of days. Maybe longer, I told him. Depends on how long it takes to finish our business here.
What might your business be, if I might ask, he said.
Well, I understand you have some men headed this way that have plans to take control of the town and have threatened some of your citizens.
That correct, I asked.
Say, he asked, are you that gunfighter the doc sent for?
Well, I don't like being referred to as a gunfighter, I said.
But yes, the doc did ask me to come and see if I could work out some kind of arrangement with these gentlemen.
Well, I don't think they're going to agree to any kind of arrangement, Whitmore said. They got just one thing on their mind, and that's payback and revenge. They claim two of our prominent citizens did them wrong by testifying in court against them, and they went to jail because of that testimony.
Say, can we set our tent up out behind your building? Asked Orville.
Oh, sure you can, said Whitmore. Be glad to have the company.
Think I'll go and talk to the sheriff, I told him. Be back as soon as I can.
"Sheriff's out of town," said Whitmore. "Deputy Harold Johansson is acting sheriff."
"Well, I reckon he'll have to do," I said.
"Levi Benson at the general store is town gossip," said Whitmore. "If you need to know something about someone, he's the one to see."
"Well, thanks," I said.
"After I check out the deputy, I'll go see him." The deputy sheriff had a craggy face with scraggly black hair and a mustache. He had his chair leaned back and his arms folded around his rotund belly, and his boots were plopped up on the desk as if everything was right in the world.
"I do you for, stranger," he said,
but he didn't change his position. "My name's Jed Jenkins," I said. "I'm here to find out what you're planning on doing about these hooligans and ruffians that are coming to your town. Your people are going to be tormented and terrorized by them. They have no morals at all, and they don't care who they hurt."
"I don't want to get killed," he said. "Besides, they'll be moving on in a couple of days, or they just might ride straight through after they have a drink."
"Who elected you deputy sheriff?" I asked.
"No one," he answered. "Sheriff was elected. I work for him. He hired me."
"Where is the sheriff?" I asked.
"Oh, he's out of town delivering a prisoner to Hayes City. Won't be back for a week or so."
"So you're just going to sit there and let those men take over the town and possibly kill someone?" I asked him.
"As I told you," he said, exasperated, "plan on living long enough to see my kids grow up."
"Well, I'd recommend you turn in your badge," I said. "Find something else to do." "I'll be back." I left the sheriff's office and went across the street to the general store. An elderly man with a concave chest and a goatee was standing behind the cash register. "May I help you with something?" he said. He didn't look strong enough to help with anything. If he stepped into the street, it wouldn't take much of a breeze to blow him into the next county.
"Are you Levi Benson?" I asked.
"That's me," he answered. "Why are you asking?"
"I was wondering what you could tell me about the deputy," I said.
"What'd you want to know?" asked Mr. Benson. "How long has he been a deputy? Is he a close friend of the sheriff? Could the town council override the sheriff's decision to hire him? Is there anyone at all in this town who isn't afraid to do what's right?" I asked.
"Well, them's a bunch of questions. As far as being a friend of the sheriff, I don't think anybody cares for Harold. He takes advantage of his position, and he's a bully when he leaves his office for any length of time. Far as the council firing him, I don't think that will happen, because the sheriff is also a bully. He considers this to be his town, and if they overrode his decision on hiring Harold, well, he'd be none too happy about that. I reckon if anything's going to get done about them ruffians, it's going to have to be you. Ain't that why you came here for?"
"I always like for the local authorities to take care of their problems," I said. "If they can't or won't, then I will step in and eliminate the problem."
"Well, thank you for the information, and good day to you."
and went back to the livery stable and let the fellows know what I had learned.
"I need to find the doctor," I said, "and let him know we're here. Mr. Benson told me where the doctor's office was located, so I walked there and knocked on the door.
It opened. "Jed, good to see you. You took my hand. I was expecting you 2 days ago."
"Well, we had a couple of delays," I said, "things that couldn't be avoided."
"Oh, I'm not questioning you," the doc said. "I'm sure whatever it was important. Anyway, you're here now, and that's what matters."
"Are they here yet?" I asked.
"No," he answered, "but from the information we received just this morning, they're about a day and a half out. They could ride into town any time, so I'm glad you're here. Judge Michelson and Mr. Hogan are frightened. Someone suggested they leave town, but these vermin that are coming would just hunt them down. There's really no place to go, and they're counting on you to help them."
"Isn't there a sheriff in this town?" I asked.
"Well, sheriff's out of town delivering a prisoner to Hayes City," the doc said. "He's not expected back for another week, and by then it'll be too late. There's a deputy, if you can call him that. He barely leaves his office, and then it's only to go to the saloon and get free drinks. I don't believe he pays for anything. He has an addiction to gambling, and he spends a lot of time at the saloon. You shouldn't expect any help from him, and I'm not very good with a gun, but I'm willing to help if I can."
"Well, I don't think that'll be necessary," I said, "but thanks. I really don't like to involve anyone else in these situations. I've already had a talk with Deputy Harold Johansson, and you're right, he won't be any help."
"Well, what are your plans?" asked the doctor.
"I don't make plans," I said. "I just do what has to be done when the time comes. Right now I'm going back to our camp and get a bite to eat. Then I want to take a little nap. Nap always helps me relax and helps my reflexes. See you later, Doc Ferguson."
"Yeah, see you later, Jed."
Chapter 15. Mid-morning the next day, Doc Ferguson came to our camp beside the livery stable.
"Jed, they're on their way," he said. "They're about 2 miles out and headed straight to town. Should be 10 to 15 minutes. Are you ready?"
"Is a person ever completely ready for a situation like this?" I said.
"I'm as ready as one can be."
"See you fellas later," I said, and I walked towards the edge of town, where the main road came into town, then removed my duster and the leather tie-down on my pistol. And I waited. 10 minutes passed, and I heard horses' hooves coming down the road. It sounded like two horses. They pulled up about 7 to 10 feet in front of me. The one on the roan stallion was thin, had a hawk-like face with beady eyes and a long pointed nose. He spoke with a slow southern drawl. The other man had a round, flush face and was sporting a handlebar mustache. They were both well-heeled. The thin one did all the talking, while the red-faced one kept shaking his head and giggling every once in a while, as if agreeing with everything the thin one was saying.
"What you doing standing in the middle of the road, kid?"
"I sure get tired of being called kid," I told him.
"What's that? Speak up. Didn't hear you," he asked.
"Maybe you'll hear this," and I spoke a little louder. "You and your partner aren't welcome in Clearstone, so best thing for you to do is turn around and head back the way you came."
"But we got business in this town," the thin man said.
"Yep, mighty important business. Best move to the side of the road before you get trampled."
"I'd hold the reins on them animals if I was you," I said. "Otherwise, someone might get hurt, and I don't think it'll be me."
Just a slight movement of his right hand, and he was laying in the street, staring up at the blue sky with empty eyes. I threw myself forward to the ground and rolled to my right. As I landed, my next bullet pushed the second man off the rear of his horse and onto the ground. It was over in just a couple of seconds. The two men were cast in eternity to meet their maker by my hand. I quietly said a prayer for the men's souls and for myself. And when it was over, the horses were still standing as if nothing had happened. The red-faced man was struggling, trying to get up. I walked over, looked down in his pale blue eyes, which seemed to be getting paler by the second.
"Help me,"
he said. His words were strangled as blood leaked from his lips.
"I'm afraid I can't help you now," I told him. "That shot killed you. Your brain just don't know it yet."
I heard a gasping sound as he tried to breathe one last breath. It didn't happen. It was over for him. He had followed his partner for the last time. I leaned over and slid his eyelids down. People came running from all directions.
"Did you ever see anyone that fast before?"
someone said excitedly. "And he's just a kid," said another. "Two men, both shot in a fair fight by the kid," said the first man. I looked over at the crowd as I replaced the spent cartridges and said quietly, "My name's not Kid or Boy. It's Jed Jenkins. Wish you'd remember that. And please tell all your friends, too." I turned away from them and walked back to the livery stable where my friends were. Dr. Ferguson was there.
"I see you did what was necessary, Jed."
"Yes," I answered, "I did what was necessary, but I wish sometimes, just sometimes, that they would choose the other path. Some men are predestined to be on the path they're on, and they can't change even if they wanted to," said the doctor. "Well, I believe everyone has a choice," I said. "It's just that the bad ones choose bad again and again, until, like the men today, it's too late." Orville said, "Well, how about we find a local eating establishment and I'll treat us to dinner?" "Now that sounds like a wonderful idea," I said. Chapter 16. Doc Ferguson showed us the way to the Stranger's Cafe, so named because when the owner came to town as a stranger, he opened the cafe and didn't take time to paint a sign. Everybody started calling it the Stranger's Cafe, and it stuck. We went in and found a table in the back. "It must be good food, because the place is almost full," said Half Loaf. "It's dinner time. All the townsfolks eat here," said the doctor. "Well, let's order something besides pork. I am tired of pork," said Half Loaf. A very pretty young lady came to our table and asked, "What'll it be, gentlemen?" "Well, what's the special today?" I asked. "Pork chops," she answered. "Oh, no," said Half Loaf. "Wait, Half Loaf, and listen to the lady," I told him. As I started to say, "Pork chops, mashed potatoes, gravy, black-eyed peas, cornbread, coffee, tea, or lemonade. Can you give us the special and switch the pork chops with steak and coffee to drink?" I asked. "Well, I'll have to check with the cook, but I don't think that'll be a problem. I'll be right back with the drinks and the answer," she said. She returned with four cups and a pot of coffee. Cook said wouldn't be a problem, but it'll cost about 10 cents more for each plate. "Well, that sounds all right," I said. "Bring it on." While we were eating, the doctor told us what had been happening since his arrival. He said the people were a little suspicious of him because of his age. They claimed he couldn't know as much as Doc Smathers because he wasn't but just a little older than the length of time Doc Smathers had been in practice. "They'll come around eventually," I said. "I'm sure of it." "Well, I sure hope you're right," said the doctor. "Just 2 weeks ago, a man died because he didn't trust a young whippersnapper who didn't hardly grow whiskers yet." We finished eating, and the doctor said he had to go out to the Snelling farm. "They've got a sick milk cow. Yes, I even treat animals," he said. "Anything to make these people trust me." Chapter 17. We were almost finished when two men came into the cafe. They hesitated at the door, looked around, then saw us, and proceeded to walk over. "Excuse the interruption," one of them said. "I'm Judge Mickelson, and this is Marvin Johnson. I believe we both owe you our gratitude. If you had not come to Clearstone, we would both probably be dead. I suppose you would like to know the reason that those men wanted us dead. If you have a moment, I'll be glad to tell you." "Well, sure," I said. "Let's move over to that table to have more room. You fellas don't mind, do you?" "No," said the doctor. "Go ahead. Hear their story." We moved to the other table and ordered coffee. "It happened in a little town just north of the border called Whispering Cactus," said the judge. "These men were on trial for robbing a stagecoach and injuring a passenger. Thank God the passenger wasn't badly hurt. Well, these two men claimed they weren't anywhere near the scene of the robbery, but when one of them let his mask slip off his face, one of the passengers, the one who was injured, remembered him and pointed to him as the one who shot him. I was the prosecuting attorney, and Marvin was on the jury. They were found guilty and sentenced to 5 years in the territorial prison. They were released last month after serving their sentence. Why they were coming after us and not the rest of the jury or the judge, well, your guess is as good as mine. I just know that both Marvin and I will be in your debt forever. If either of us can ever be a help in any way, please do not hesitate to let us know. Again, with humble hearts, we say thank you." Chapter 18. As the waitress kept walking back and forth,
I noticed her dark hair was piled high on her head, with just a few tendrils falling loosely around her face. The plain blue cotton dress accentuated the curves of her slim body. She was indeed a fine-looking young woman. After we finished, I told the fellas I would meet them back at the camp.
All right, said Orville. We'll see you later.
When the waitress walked by the table, I asked for another cup of coffee. Sure thing, she said. It'll just be a second.
My name's Jed, I said.
What's your name?
My name's Molly McGuire, she answered.
Have you lived here long? I asked.
Well, all my life. I was born here in Clearstone 18 years ago yesterday.
Well, happy late birthday to you, I said.
Aren't you the young man that killed those men this morning? She asked.
Yes, I answered. That was me. Someone had to stop them, or the judge and his friend would have been hurt, or more likely killed.
Oh, I'm not accusing you of anything, she said. It's just that you look so young to be a killer.
Well, I don't think of myself as a killer, I said. More of a peacekeeper and a protector of the people.
Well, I suppose you're right, but I need to get back to work. Maybe I'll see you later.
I'd like that, I said.
What time do you get off?
Around 7:30, she said.
Can I come by so we can go for a walk, I asked.
Well, that sounds fine, she answered.
I'll see you then.
I left and went back to the camp, got clean clothes, and headed straight for the barber shop for a bath. I don't know what it is about a hot bath that's so relaxing. I almost fell asleep in the tub. I dried off, then dressed in my clean clothes, and on the way out, I paid for the bath and asked to borrow a comb.
Now, you look like a fella that's got a date, said the barber. How about a little of this tonic water for your hair?
Oh, yes, I could have a date, I said. Thanks for the use of the comb and the tonic. It was close to 7, so I decided to walk around a little until it was time. I was walking on the boardwalk in front of the saloon when a man came through the door. He was a little wobbly on his feet, so I stepped out of his way to let him pass. He stopped in front of me, and I saw it was Harold, the deputy sheriff.
Hey, you didn't need my help after all, did you? He said. Guess you're big shot now, ain't you?
Think you need to go home and try again in the morning, Harold.
Just 'cause you're a big shot don't give you no right to tell me what to do. Just get out of my way and I'll be okay, he said.
I stepped down off the boardwalk, completely out of his way.
That's better, he said. Better remember who I am. I'm the deputy sheriff, and don't you forget it.
Go on home, Harold, I said. Sleep it off. You'll feel better in the morning.
Think that's what I'm going to do, he said. Goodbye.
He struggled to walk straight and bumped the sides of the building. I was afraid he might go the wrong way and fall out into the street, but I guess it's like Pa used to say, God watches out for fools and drunks. It was very close to 7:30, so I walked up to the cafe. I waited outside the door, and after a few minutes, Molly came out.
Do you mind if we stop by my house so I can get my heavy coat? She asked.
No, I don't mind at all, I said. Which way?
It's just a little ways up the street.
We walked almost to the end of the street when she said, We turn here. This one is where I live. Do you want to come inside while I freshen up a bit and get my coat?
Why, sure. I can do that, I said.
Thanks, she said. I followed her inside. The warmth of the house felt good.
Please go on in the living room and have a seat. I'll just be a few minutes.
I went into the living room and sat down. In a couple of seconds, a man who looked to be around 40 years old came in.
Hello. You must be a friend of Molly's.
Yes, sir. We're going for a walk when she gets her warmer coat.
Well, Molly only has one coat. I think this is her way of getting me to check you out, he said. Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Well, my name's Jed Jenkins, and I'm almost 20. I'm from Angel Falls, Texas. My father was murdered there recently, and I'm now traveling the country trying to follow the will of God.
Do you feel that God led you here to Clearstone? He asked.
Yes, sir, I do, I answered. I go where God leads me, and I feel he definitely led me here.
And where exactly does Molly fit into this plan of God's? He asked.
Oh, I saw a pretty girl, and I thought she might enjoy going for a walk, I said. So, here we are.
Okay, Jed, I guess you pass. All right, Molly, Jed's waiting, he spoke loudly. She came around the corner. I thought she looked good before, but then couldn't compare to now.
She had changed out of her blue dress and was now wearing a pink gingham shirt and blouse. She had also changed her hair. It was hanging down almost to her shoulders, and it looked like it had changed colors. It was dark brown before, but now it was almost raven black. "Are you ready to go, Jed?" she said as she slipped into the same coat she was wearing before. "Here, help me with my shawl, please." We told her father good night and went out into the winter weather. "Where would you like to walk?" I asked. "Or anywhere will be fine." She slipped her arm through mine, and I inhaled her scent. She smelled of rose water and a clean, soapy smell, a little different than what I was used to smelling all day on the trail. We walked around up one street and down another. "Let's sit here on the bench in front of the cafe," she said, as we sat down and she snuggled right up against me. "You feel nice and warm. How long are you staying here in Clearstone?" "Well, I really haven't given it any thought," I answered. "Probably a couple of weeks, maybe more, maybe less." "Well, I hope you stay longer," she said. "I could get to like you a lot." "I think I could like you a lot, too," I said. "Have you got a girlfriend?" she asked. "No," I answered. "I don't have a girlfriend." "Well, if you stay, maybe I can be your girlfriend," she said. "Have to be honest with you, Molly. I can't have a girlfriend because of what I do. I couldn't or wouldn't put that burden on someone I care for. I never know when or where I'm going." "Well, I think you would like having me as your girlfriend," she said. "Yes," I said, "I probably would, but as I said, I don't want to burden anyone with the things I have to do." "Well, maybe if you stay, we can keep seeing each other," she said. "Who knows, you might change your mind." "I wouldn't want you to get your hopes up, only to be disappointed later," I said. "However, if you understand that we can't or won't be girlfriend and boyfriend, then I would like to continue seeing you." "Well, that sounds good to me," she said. "Tomorrow at the same time?" "Sounds good to me," I said. We went for walks almost every night after she got off work, and even went for a couple of buggy rides. Molly was bound and determined to change my mind and be my girlfriend. As I said in the past, I have only kissed 3 girls in my life. Molly's kisses were special, but they didn't compare to Lacey Watkins' kisses in Velvet Sky, Arizona. Now, just because they weren't as good didn't mean I was going to stop kissing her. Pa always said, to get something right, you have to keep trying and trying. Molly did everything in her power to persuade me, except the one thing that I wouldn't do anyway. She was sure a sweet girl, and she will always have a place in my heart. You know, as a young growing boy, I have certain urges and desires. I have to pray daily for God to help me keep strong against those temptations. Chapter 19. Wolf and me were walking on the south side of town one day when he became very agitated. "What is it, boy? What's the matter?" He took off running out across the prairie. I followed as best I could, hollering for him to at least slow down. About a mile from town, there was a little log cabin next to a spring and a grove of trees. Wolf ran up to the door and started barking and climbing on it. "Come on, Wolf, take it easy," I said. The door opened and a man stepped out, and it was clear that he was blind. "Is that you, Butch?" And he reached down to touch Wolf. Wolf was very excited. He wasn't jumping up on the man, but you could see that he was excited. "Where have you been, boy?" the man asked Wolf. Wolf nuzzled his hand. "Who you got with you, Butch?" "Well, my name's Jed Jenkins," I said, "and the dog's name is Wolf. Has been now for going on 4 months." "Well, I lost Butch almost 5 months ago," he said. "Haven't been able to look for him because, well, as you can see, I'm blind. I've a really hard time getting along without him. He helps me with everything. Where'd you say you found him?" "Well, in a town called Angry Orchard in Colorado Territory," I said. "He was getting into a lot of trouble there, so I kind of adopted him." "Well, I know he's a good dog," said the man, "and I want him to be happy, so I won't try to take him away from you." "Well, that's what I want, too," I said, "for him to be happy." "How long has he been your dog?" 7 years next May," said the man. "Well, that doesn't start to compare to 4 months, does it?" I said. "Why don't we ask Butch what he wants?" said the man. "No," I said, "I don't want him to have to choose. He's your dog, I can see that. I just want to say goodbye to him, if you don't mind." "I surely don't mind," said the man. "Wolf, I wondered why you came into my life the way you did. Now I know."
You didn't have any way of getting back home without me bringing you. That's what God had planned all along. Well, goodbye, good buddy. Have a blessed life. And I gave him a big hug. By the way, my name's Jethro McClure, the man said. Can't begin to thank you for bringing my friend back to me. No thanks necessary, Mr. McClure, I said. Just take care of him the way he takes care of you. Goodbye. God bless you. I turned and walked back towards town, and I heard Wolf whine. I turned and looked one last time at him. He woofed once and then sat down beside Jethro. I waved, then turned and walked to town. It was a sad time in our camp that night. Half-Loaf said, he and I were just learning to get along. Yes, I said, but what we want's what's best for him, don't we? And Mr. McClure has been having a hard time getting around without Wolf's help to guide him. I think we're forgetting who's in charge of things that happen in our lives. God has ordained us to help those who are in need. Wolf was in trouble, and we just didn't know what kind. I thought it was rescuing him from that man that was beating him, but it was something a lot more important. It was getting two lost souls together that had been separated, and that's what we did. We should ask God's forgiveness for being so selfish about Wolf. Let him go where he belongs. Chapter 20. The sheriff came looking for me when he got back in town. He was short and heavy and wearing a double-breasted dark brown suit and a white shirt topped with a string tie. He had a holster on the left side turned backwards. A lot of men wore their guns that way. It was called a cross-draw. They were not good with their left hand, so they reached across and drew it with their right. Some were fast, some were not, and paid the price for it. I understand some of my people asked you to come and take care of some business for them, he asked. Yes, I told him. I was asked to come and help them out of a bad situation, a situation that you were unavailable to help them with at the time. Seemed to me that you had to go out of town at exactly the same time that certain bad men were supposed to show up in your town. That was official business, he said. That prisoner had to be in Hayes City before the end of the week. And you couldn't let your deputy take him? I asked. You met Harold, didn't you? Would you count on him following through on any job you might give him? He said. Then why keep him on as your deputy? I asked. Oh, he usually does what I tell him to do, and besides, every sheriff needs a deputy. It looks good. How long you plan on staying around? He asked. I haven't decided, I said, but when I do, you'll be the first to know. Yeah, try not to kill anybody else while I'm in town, said the sheriff. I hate to have to arrest you. If I have to kill someone, it'll happen whether you let it happen or not, I said. Look, I don't want any trouble. If you leave me alone, I'll leave you alone. Deal? Deal, he said. Turned and walked away. Chapter 21. One day when I was walking through town, a stoop-shouldered old man with a long beard bumped into me. I said, I'm sorry, but he brushed past me without so much as a how do you do. I thought nothing of it and continued on my way. I had almost reached the end of the street when I heard someone holler my name. Jed Jenkins, where are you? I hollered back, I'm right here. Stand where you are. I'm coming to you. Holler again so I can get a bead on you. I'm here, I said. There you are. You sure are hard to find. It was the same elderly gentleman who had bumped into me earlier. What can I do for you, sir? I asked. Or you can take this gall-darn letter that came in the mail to you 4 days ago. I didn't know you had a post office, I said. Of course we got a post office, he said sarcastically. How else would people get letters? Well, thank you for bringing it to me. I appreciate it very much. Now, who would be sending me a letter, and how did they know where I was at this time? I walked over to a bench and sat down. Then I opened the letter and began to read. It said, Dear Jed, you don't know me, but if you'll keep reading, I think you will understand why I'm writing to you. I received a letter from my brother in Velvet Sky, and he told me about you. I am your Uncle Justin. I am the youngest of the four brothers. James told me about Jeremiah, and even though we parted with harsh words, he was still my brother. I always planned on telling him that I was sorry and that I loved him. I guess I waited too long. Your Uncle James told me how you were traveling around the country helping people in need.
I think you are undertaking an admirable task. We need more people like you in the world. And you're probably asking how I knew where to send this letter. Clearstone isn't the only place I sent the letter. I tried to figure out where you might go next and from where you had been, and Clearstone was last on my list. Now, why am I writing to you? As I said, I never got a chance to tell your pa how sorry I was, or to tell him how much I loved him. So I figured I'd do the next best thing and tell his son, my nephew. Now I realize I could do this with a letter like this one, but I really would like to do it in person. If you could fit a visit to me into your schedule, then I would be ever so happy. I live in Itching Tree, Idaho territory. I have a fairly large spread here, and I might add a very successful potato farm. Jeremiah would probably be ashamed of me for not raising cattle, but that was James's dream, not mine. And your pa always told each of us to follow our dreams. Your pa's dream was to be a blacksmith. I understand he fulfilled that dream and beyond. So I ask you again, please come visit, nephew. Chapter 22. I hurried back to camp to tell Orville and Halfloaf about the letter. I wanted to tell him I had another uncle, and he wanted to see me.
When you want to plan on leaving? Asked Orville.
We have to load up with supplies and check the wagon and horses over. Long trip. Take more than a month if we don't have any delays. You know how that worked out for us on our last trip, I said. And I also feel I should try to explain to Molly. You know, I've been seeing her almost every day.
Well, I reckon she's going to cry and beg you not to go, said Orville.
She might just up and die from loneliness when you're gone. Well, can't put it off forever, I said. I better go talk to her.
Oh, you could just leave without telling her anything, said Orville. That way you won't have to listen to her crying and carrying on.
Is that what you'd do? I asked. Either one of you just up and leave, possibly scarring them for the rest of their life?
Well, I reckon you're right, said Orville. You usually are.
Well, I'll be back as soon as I can, I said, and I walked away.
Chapter 23. I walked to the cafe and went inside. Molly smiled when she saw me, then she made a sign saying, "Just a minute." She was wearing a plain blue skirt and lace-trimmed waistcoat, with her hair piled up high on her head, just the way she looked the first time I saw her. When she did finally come over, I asked if she could come outside so I could talk to her. She said she would tell George, the owner of the Stranger's Cafe. We went out, and I asked if she wanted to sit or walk.
"Let's sit," she said, "if it's really important."
"I feel it's very important," I said.
"I guess there's only one way to say this, Molly. I'm leaving town, probably early tomorrow."
"Oh, Jed, you can't do that. I won't let you," she said.
"Molly, I don't want to hurt you, but you can't stop me. You knew when we began seeing one another that it was never going to be a permanent thing."
"But I thought if we just kept seeing one another, you would change your mind," she said. "Maybe even learn to love me."
"Well, I care for you very much," I said, "but I can't stay. I'm so sorry."
"Do you realize that I practically put my life on hold for you?" she said. "I have not even spoken to another boy since we started going out. Doesn't that count for something?"
"Do you remember I told you that very first night that we could never be more than friends?" I asked.
"Don't you love me just a little?" she asked. "What can I do to change your mind? Please, Jed, tell me what I can do."
"Again,
are special to me," I said. "You will always have a place in my heart, but that's all it can be. Please try to understand that I don't mean to hurt you, but I must leave. Would you at least give me a goodbye kiss?" she asked.
"Of course I will," I said.
We kissed, and maybe it was all that practice we'd had, but this last kiss really reached down inside me and shook me to my toes.
"Goodbye, Molly," I said as I stood and turned and left.
"Goodbye, my love," I heard her say. "My sweet Jed."
Chapter 24. I walked back towards our camp and then turned at 4th Street and went to Doc Ferguson's office. Knocked on the door. He answered and said, "Come in, Jed. It's good to see you. We haven't had much time to visit since you've been here. Been so busy. As it looks now, tomorrow is looking like I might have some free time. How'd you like to have dinner?" he said. "Well, that sounds good, Doc, but
We're leaving early in the morning.
Did you get a message that you needed someplace? He asked.
Well, yes and no, I said. My uncle wrote me a letter, said he would like for me to come and visit him. We've never met, and both of us are really looking forward to meeting.
Well, that sounds very good, said the doc. We all have a need to stay in touch with family.
Sometimes I wish I had a family. Where's your uncle live?
Well, he lives in Itching Tree, Idaho. Owns a potato farm. Very successful one, or so he says.
Well, that's a very interesting name for a town, said the doc. Wonder how it got its name.
I'm sure I'll find out when I get there, and I'll write you, I said.
I want to thank you again, Jed, for coming when I asked you to. You didn't have to, but you did. Even after I questioned you about the ethics of what you were going to do in Velvet Sky, you came anyway. You're a true friend. May God continue to guide you as you seek to do His will.
Goodbye, Doc, I said, and may God bless you and guide your hands.
Chapter 25
Orville and Half-Loaf had everything packed, and we were ready to travel. Orville asked, "Do you break that little girl's heart and make her cry?"
"Well, I don't think it's anything to be flippant about," I said.
"Yes, I told her, and yes, she cried. It also made me feel bad that I had to do it."
"Sometimes life hurts," said Orville. "We have to shake it off and continue on."
Half-Loaf had already saddled Sugar for me, and he and Orville had already checked and packed the wagons. They were ready to go.
Then why was I hesitating? Was there something I needed to do before I left this town? I told everyone that was important to me goodbye.
So what was it?
I mounted up, looked back over at the fellas, and nodded my head and said, "Let's ride."
As we turned on the main street, we had to pass in front of the Stranger's Cafe.
There, standing on the boardwalk, was sweet Molly Maguire, in a pretty pink dress, her face aglow with shiny tears running down her cheeks. She had her hair high on her head, the way I liked it, and she was smiling, but I could see it was a fake smile. As we passed, she raised her hand in a parting gesture, touched it to her lips, and blew me a kiss. I touched the brim of my hat, nodded to her, then turned away to face the journey ahead.
Sugar was raring to go. Since I began this trek across the states, we had not been taking our morning rides through the country the way we did before this all started. I silently promised myself right then that when we reached Uncle Justin's farm, we would start riding again, just for the fun of it. What was in store for us in Itching Tree, Idaho? Only God knew. I settled down into the saddle and looked at where we had been and where we were going. It all pretty much looked the same. Maybe the trees were different, and maybe the landscape had changed a little. There were subtle changes, all right, but one thing stayed the same, the beautiful, wonderful handiwork of the Lord. The sun, the moon, the stars remained fixed in the glorious sky, planted there with His mighty hand. His hands paint the flowers, and they put the leaves on the trees, and at His whisper, the birds start singing. He's the kind of God I believe in. I was looking forward to 500 miles of traveling with my two best friends. Maybe I'm not cut out to be a city boy. Maybe I'm supposed to be traveling all the time from one place where I'm needed to the next. If that's what I'm supposed to do, then I will do it gladly, and with a peace in my heart that I'm fulfilling my destiny of what God intended me to do with my life. As I rocked back and forth in my saddle, I uttered a prayer of thanksgiving and asked God to bless me, my friends, and this journey to visit my uncle in Itching Tree, Idaho.
Chapter 26
As I turned to look one last time, I saw Doc Ferguson running down the street hollering, "Hold it, Jed! Hold up!"
"Hold it, fellas. Something's wrong."
"What is it, Doc? What's wrong?"
"The sheriff's been killed. Happened about 15 minutes ago. A man named Wichita Phil rode into town. He went to the saloon and threatened to kill the bartender if he didn't serve him fast enough, then asked who the sheriff was in this good-for-nothing town and started shooting the bottles behind the bar. He emptied his gun, reloaded, and started shooting again. This time he shot the chandelier and it fell to the floor, smashing into a million pieces. About then the sheriff came into the saloon and said, 'How about you stop destroying property and holster your gun, and we won't have to arrest you?' The man lifted his gun and shot the sheriff in cold blood.
The sheriff didn't have a chance. He just shot him down.
And then he said, I'm taking over this town. Anybody don't like it, better speak up now.
I didn't think so. Somebody go and get your mayor. He needs to appoint a new sheriff. And I think that'll probably be me.
Bartender, pour me another whiskey.
Well, how about Harold, I asked. Where is he? Isn't he supposed to take over if something happens to the sheriff?
Are you kidding? Said the doc. Harold couldn't find his way out of a paper bag with the top open.
I think you're the one we need. I know you're leaving, but could you stay and see what you can do to alleviate this problem?
Orville, you and Half Loaf go back to the livery stable and wait.
I won't be long. Here, take Sugar with you.
I removed my duster and the leather tie-down on my pistol and walked back down Main Street past Molly, who was still standing in front of the cafe. She had her hands folded under her chin as if in prayer. I nodded as I passed, and she nodded back. I walked through the front door of the saloon. The man was standing with his back to the door. He reached for the glass of whiskey the bartender had just poured and put it to his lips. Then he leaned his head back and swallowed. He slammed the glass down against the bar, then turned and looked me up and down. He was small in stature, maybe 5'1", and weighed probably 115 pounds. He was wearing leather breeches, a buckskin shirt, and a leather hat, and his gun was low and tied down. He had one blue eye looking straight ahead and one green eye looking off to the left, and it was hard to tell if he was looking at you or around you.
"Why, you're just a kid. Why don't you go play with the other little boys and tell them to send a grown-up to take care of me?"
He turned back to the bar and said to the bartender, "Pour another one."
"Yes, sir," said the bartender.
I stepped in close to him, then reached out and tapped him on the shoulder. He jerked upright, whirled around, and reached for his gun in one swift movement. But I had anticipated his move as soon as I tapped his shoulder, and I stepped back to my right. He momentarily lost sight of me as he spun around. I had my pistol in my hand and shouted for him to drop his weapon. He turned in my direction and raised his gun, but he only got it up to waist level when the slug knocked him back against the door. He looked down at the hole in his chest just to the left of his heart.
"But you're just a kid," he said as he slid into the sawdust floor.
"I sure don't like being called kid," I said as I replaced the spent cartridge and slipped my pistol into my holster.
"You know, drinking whiskey can kill you," I said, and I turned and walked out through the saloon door.
"Is he dead? Is it really over?" someone in the street asked.
"Yes, he's dead," I said. "Someone needs to call the undertaker."
"Or he's on his way," the man said. "He always hangs back until the shooting's over. Then he comes a-running. There he is now."
Chapter 27.
Like Pa always told me, pay attention to those feelings you have way down in your gut. Don't quit before the job is done. I knew yesterday when we were leaving that something was being left unfinished, and sure enough, there was a job only I could do. We said our goodbyes again, except I didn't say anything more to Molly. I left things as they were. We headed down the road and out of town.
You're invited to enjoy this short preview of the next in the series, Itching Tree, Idaho. The town was named Itching Tree because when the first settlers arrived, one of the trees was covered with both poison oak and poison ivy. Anyone who got near it would itch for days, even weeks. Only one out of several trees was contaminated. The people tried everything to get rid of the poison, but nothing seemed to work. Then one day, magically almost 6 months later, the tree was clear of all signs of the poison. No one knows what happened. It seemed like a miracle that occurred overnight. My Uncle Justin had sent me a letter asking me to come and visit with him in Itching Tree. He said he was a very successful potato farmer there, so after saying goodbye to everyone twice, we were on our way to Idaho. It was going to be a long trip, but I was looking forward to traveling. I suppose I just wasn't cut out to live in a city. I much preferred the open skies with the stars shining down on me. In fact, as I looked up, I wondered how God could place each one of those twinkling stars right in its particular spot, exactly where He wanted them to be. Half Loaf began singing a Mexican ballad. I didn't understand the words, but I had to admit he had a very nice voice.
now to get him to learn some songs in English. I saw a couple of wild animals run out of sight, and I thought about Wolf. I sure did miss him. Wolf was our dog until we found he belonged to Mr. McClure in Clearstone, who was blind. He and Wolf, or Butch, which was his real name, had been together for, I think he said, 7 years. It had been hard for him to get around for the 5 months Butch wasn't with him. It was a sad day for all of us when we left him behind. But as I explained to Orville and Halfloaf, that's what we do. We help folks who are in trouble, and in that case, it was a dog that needed help. He was lost, far from his home and owner, and so we helped him and reunited the two of them. I said it was a sad day, and yes, it was sad that we were leaving a good friend behind, but it was a bittersweet sadness because at the same time we were happy to see a man and his dog together again. I sure hoped Orville had stocked up with some good eats. I was getting a little bit hungry. About an hour later, he asked, "Are you ready to stop for the night? We still got a little daylight." "Ready if you guys are," I said. "My belly button is rubbing my backbone right now. I sure hope you've got a good meal planned." "Okay," said Orville. "Looks like a good spot right up there next to that thicket of trees." We maneuvered our way through the scrub brush and cacti and parked next to the thicket. "I'll gather the firewood for you if you take care of my horse, Jed," volunteered Halfloaf.
"And since your belly button's rubbing your backbone," said Orville, "I'll go ahead and get a meal started if you'll unhitch the wagon."
"Well, sounds like you fellas have it all planned so you don't have to take care of your animals," I said.
"It's not that at all," said Orville. "Just trying to get things in an organized manner."
"All right," I said. "Well, forgive me if I don't seem to want to be organized." And soon, I unhooked the horses from the buckboard and had removed the saddles from the other two. There was a scent in the air that was very pleasing to me. Stopped what I was doing and tried to locate where it was coming from. Orville already had something cooking that made my mouth water. And just about then he hollered,
"Come and get it. It's ready."
He had sliced some beef loin really thin, fried them, made a gravy, and mixed the two together. He also had something that Mr. Finnegas had called dried potato flakes. He claimed all you had to do was mix about a cupful in boiling water, stir it, and magically you had mashed potatoes. Sure enough, they looked just like mashed potatoes. He also cut thick slices from a loaf of bread, and there was a quart jar of butter sitting there to smooth right over it. Right beside all that was Orville's famous coffee, in the old, bent, but still useful coffee pot. The smell was wreaking havoc on my stomach. Orville handed each of us a tin plate with a spoon and said,
"Both big enough and old enough to help yourselves."
Well, maybe it was because I was so hungry, but that was just one of the best meals I have eaten in a long time. And after the meal, when the dishes were cleaned up and put away, Orville asked,
"Halfloaf, you know any American songs?"
"Just a few that the Padre taught me. I do not think you would like them because I was very small when he taught me."
"Well, why don't you let us decide?" I said.
"Okay, here is one," and started to sing. This has been Clearstone, Wyoming, written by J.C. Halsey, narrated by Chaz Allen, copyright 2015 by J.C. Halsey, production copyright 2015 by Outlaws Publishing.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.